Mike, can you just tell us, like, what's usually at the top of your shopping list when you cross the border?
Well, based on customer requests, the number one things I need to be getting are cheese and wine, and we're not allowed to bring in either of them. So I have to go to number three on the list before I'm in business, which is basically plantain chips, chocolate-covered almonds.
This is Mike Halleck. He runs a store in Vancouver, British Columbia called Pirate Joe's, and you may have heard of him. His business model involves driving into Washington State in a big van and loading it up with stuff from Trader Joe's grocery stores and then taking it back to Vancouver and reselling it to Canadians who are surly that they don't have a Trader Joe's north of the border. And I'm Gabriel Spitzer, by the way.
I'll say, I don't know. I'll go get it.
And this is Sound Effect.
So, an unsweetened, unsulfured mango slices.
Do you ever get questioned at the border about what you are bringing in?
Yeah, absolutely I do. Like, you need a special permit to bring in dog treats if they have meat in them. So I ended up being escorted out to the trash can. It was kind of like a walk of shame, and you had to take them all out of the bags, these little jerky treats, and then dump them. There I was, this shamed pirate.
So I just wonder how your experiences have affected the way you think about the border and about boundaries. I mean, do you think of it as something that is meaningful, something arbitrary?
Well, they're arbitrary in so far as current time frame. I mean, they were set up for reasons that have long since vanished. And so, you know, we've got this leftover baggage from an old economy, and now we're in this new global age, and those boundaries just really need to go away. And unfortunately, with every system that gets set up, there's this, you know, enterprise that springs up around it. Depending on the inefficiencies that have been created by these boundaries, and they make money off of them. And so they're not happy with any disruption. So it's very hard to budge this.
But Mike, aren't you now one of the people who does profit from the inefficiencies around this boundary?
Well, small p profit. I'm doing it more, I'm not creating any wealth. I'm creating some value in terms of saving people time. You know, I go over there and get the stuff for you, and I charge you for that. And I just think that, you know, if you took all that stuff out, people could innovate and create wealth way more efficiently. And I think we'd just end up with a way better life experience.
If Trader Joe's were to open up a location in Vancouver, would you happily go out of business?
Joyfully.
I'll just add that Trader Joe's did eventually sue Mike Hallett, alleging that he was illegally reselling their goods and violating a bunch of their trademarks. And the court threw out the suit, saying that Trader Joe's wasn't actually being harmed by this arrangement and that they were actually benefiting because Hallett was spending like tens of thousands of dollars at their stores. And furthermore, that the trademark infringement stuff doesn't apply because Mike is in Canada. So the border actually saved his Canadian bacon. Well, today on Sound Effect, stories of boundaries, pushing them, crossing them, breaking them. That's all coming up just ahead. But first, as usual, we are going to hit the high points of the week's news with a panel of guests, so stay tuned. Here's the part on Sound Effect where we recap the week's top story, as well as restore balance in the universe by giving some attention to the week's underreported stories. And here to help me do that are Hannah Brooks Olson. She's one-third of the politics and news blog Seattle-ish. Aaron Burkhalter is senior reporter at Real Change Newspaper. And Sarah Studeville is co-founder and creative director at Seattle Globalist. Hey, guys, welcome to Sound Effect.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So this week we had step one of the journey toward $15 an hour minimum wage here in Seattle. It's had lots of ripple effects both in the media and in the business community and elsewhere, and we're going to talk about some of that stuff. So Hannah, maybe you could begin by kind of recapping what has snapped into focus a little bit this week.
This was a really exciting week. On April 1st, we took the first step towards getting to $15 an hour, which started with companies in town who have more than 500 employees. Everyone got bumped to $11 an hour. If you have under 500 employees, you got bumped to $10 an hour, and then a sort of a floating dollar that your employer could either cover with healthcare or with total compensation, which is going to get phased out after the whole thing is over. But it was a first step, and it was a big first step because for employees formerly making, you know, real minimum wage, this was a difference of a dollar, $2. Like, it's real money. And there were several issues that were sort of immediately noted with this rollout. And one of the first ones is that the city of Seattle has a sort of a long history of implementing worker-facing legislature that is great in theory and maybe really hard to enforce or implement. And so one of the biggest issues is that the Office of Compliance at the mayor's office is not fully staffed yet. And so there are people who either don't know that they got a raise, people who maybe got a raise and don't know who to turn to make sure it's correct. And so there's been a lot of outside parties who have sort of shown up on the scene to be helpful. So one of them is Shama Sawant, and 15 Now tried to run some bus ads, which were denied because they were viewed as political. And then also Working Washington created a website, whatsmywage.org, and where employees could go to check because the actual city of Seattle kind of hadn't provided those services really. And so what we're noticing is that it's kind of a group effort.
Yeah, well, at the Seattle Globalist, you know, we're really focused in our coverage of the minimum wage on how this is impacting immigrant communities in particular and international communities. And back in 2013, there was a lot of back and forth about, is the minimum wage good or bad for immigrants? Because immigrant business owners who already have really tight margins might really be pushed up against it. But ultimately, a lot of these lower paid service jobs are held by people in immigrant communities and people in communities of color and so on and so forth. So that's what I'm really interested in seeing, is kind of how that plays out. Though I would say, sort of from where we're sitting, that's going to be more interesting if this minimum wage gets expanded to the rest of the state. Because actually, most of our immigrant communities, most of our communities of color and international communities are outside the Seattle city limits. So if that happens, and there were some rumblings about that already this week, I think that's when we'll really see an impact on those communities, and I think that'd be very interesting.
Well, of course, this sort of originated outside of the city of Seattle in one of our nearby communities where there are a lot of immigrant workers. And Aaron Burkhalter, you covered a lot of the campaign in SeaTac, the first sort of $15 wage campaign in the area. Any lessons to be learned from that area?
I think there's actually a lot because, I mean, you heard the exact same things from business owners there a year ago when it was implemented there. And to be clear, in SeaTac, it's applying to hospitality workers. So parking lots related to the airport, hotels, restaurants attached to hotels. But, you know, when this started there, the Cedarbrook Lodge manager that was formerly working there is no longer there, was saying that they might have to cut back the number of rooms and they might have to cut back the number of employees they have. There were parking companies that were really nervous about what would impact them. And then before too long, you kind of saw the reverse, which was Cedarbrook Lodge is now expanding and adding the number of rooms they had. And you'll go through SeaTac now and you'll see these parking garages with these big signs that say $15 an hour. I mean, they're advertising the pay that they get to offer people.
Oh, interesting.
As an incentive to employees.
It's a selling point now.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, sure. The competitive nature of being able to offer more money to your employees is something that I feel like when there's been a ton of talk about how this is going to affect business owners and what they're going to do. And, you know, most notably this week, Tom Douglas was talking about how because he has more than 500 employees, he's not going to be as competitive of a restaurant because he's going to have to raise his prices. But what that doesn't take into account is that that also makes him a more competitive employer.
And I think that's kind of a frustrating thing about this as a potentially overreported story, is we're sure hearing a lot from people like Tom Douglas and not always a lot from people who really do stand to benefit the most from it. And one other possible implication here that I just was thinking about as we were talking, and Aaron, I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on this, is whether or not this increasing minimum wage can do anything to address this issue of diversity within the Seattle city limits as well. Is this something that can bring some of those international communities, communities of color, and maybe lower income communities back into the Seattle city limits, or is just housing and cost of living going to be too high?
My gut reaction is just say that the cost of living in Seattle is still really high. The National Low Income Housing Alliance does a study every year where they determine how much you need to make to be able to afford a two-bedroom apartment anywhere in the country. And in Seattle, it's $21.60 an hour. So if you're a single parent, you're working a minimum wage job, you're making $11 an hour right now, it's still going to be really hard to live in Seattle.
All right, well, that's our week's top story. I'm here with Hannah Brooks Olson, Aaron Burkhalter, and Sarah Studeville on Sound Effect. Now we're going to turn our attention to the week's undercovered stories, a story here or there that you would like to see get a little bit more attention. And Aaron Burkhalter, maybe we can start with you.
Yeah, I think my undercovered story of the week, of course, something that got a lot of attention was the Seattle City Council passing its encampment ordinance. And what this essentially does is it allows organizations that operate tent cities to operate on privately owned land and city-owned land just as easily as they can now through religious institutions. So religious institutions have very few restrictions on where and how they operate tent cities, and now there's all this land that's opened up for that. What I think has kind of been undercovered is that the legislation itself does not actually create encampments, and it doesn't itself fund encampments. And so that's really what's on my mind is how do we get from that point to having this not just be a new place for the existing encampments to go, but to be a way to expand the number of encampments so we can expand the number of places that the, you know, more than 2,000 people who are sleeping outdoors at night can stay.
Now, the funding and actual execution of those three tent cities, newly permitted tent cities, Aaron Burkhalter's underreported story. Thank you so much for that. So, Hannah Brooks Olson, while we're on the subject of Mayor Murray and housing, what's your underreported story?
My underreported story is kind of similar to Aaron's in that it's an announcement that was made with very little fanfare, but also very little plan for execution. So Ed Murray has been working for months sort of in, not necessarily back rooms, but he's been working with various entities to try to figure out an affordable housing solution. He's trying to figure out how to house all of those people who are sleeping outside, but also all of the people who are in interim housing and all of the people who are on the wait list and all of the people who are in areas where they might not want to live, the ones who live in Renton.
Right, and this has been kind of like a drumbeat. This has been a big, you know, this is sort of the next big issue that we're tackling. Like, for example, on the scale of the minimum wage, there have been task forces galore and lots of meetings and public meetings and public input and so on. And then we get this announcement kind of sprung up in the B section of the paper.
Yeah, it was sort of came by surprise. The only place I saw it was on Seattle.gov and in a press release in my inbox, but I didn't see much else. But Ed Murray basically said that in the next 10 years, we'll be building 50,000 new units for people to live in, and 20,000 of them would be affordable. So there's several issues with this, one of which is it's over the next 10 years, which is a really long time to keep people waiting for affordable housing. The other is 50,000 is a lot of units. There's literally not space. Josh Veit from Publicola put it in the way that it's basically six South Lake unions, South Lakes Union, I suppose. Right. And there's just not room with the way that zoning occurs in the city now with single family housing and multifamily housing. Like, there's just, I don't know where those are going to go. And I don't know how the developers are going to be convinced to build 20,000 affordable housing units. I don't know how he's going to incentivize that. He has set it at the 80% annual median income as laid out by HUD, which is a pretty standard yardstick. But if we are increasing minimum wage in the city 10 years from now, when everyone in the minimum wage is making $15 or even $16 an hour, that federal level might not really apply, or even a city level might need to be readjusted. And so there's a lot of logistical issues to this announcement that sounds really cool, where he's like, oh, almost half of new houses built in the next 10 years will be affordable. Like, if you just see that headline, that's great. But I didn't even see that headline this week. He just sort of made an announcement, waved his hand, and then kind of moonwalked off stage. So I'm not really sure. I don't really know what he was planning to have happen with that, but I don't know that it happened.
All right. Sarah Studeville, how about your underreported story?
So my underreported story of the week, I think maybe is also my underreported story of the decade here in the Pacific Northwest. And that's about the Northwest Detention Center. For people who don't know, there's the Northwest Detention Center, also sometimes called the NWDC, on the Tacoma Tide Flats. It was built early 2000s, kind of post 9/11. There was a push for funding to create these detention centers for people who had pending immigration cases, right? And if you go there, which I have, because I've reported on it for about a decade now, it's very much like a prison. It's a detention center. So these are people that may be getting deported, don't know, they're waiting to go before an immigration judge of some kind. So this contract has been owned by a private corporation called the GEO Group since the founding of the NWDC, and has just pretty steadily been renewed. Each time it's up for renewal, GEO Group gets it again. And so I think that right there, kind of the existence of the NWDC, is a little bit of an underreported story. The fact that this private corporation that is actually I believe they're originally from Florida, keeps getting this contract, is underreported. And then kind of adding to it is this fact that the detention center is less full than it has been. So these beds aren't necessarily full, but these contracts are decided by how many beds there are in the center. So GL Group just got renewed at this level that presumed a full detention center when, in fact, it hasn't been full now for the last couple of years. So it's kind of one of those situations where an out-of-state private company is getting this kind of weird subsidy to do this sort of controversial thing totally under the radar.
All right, Northwest Detention Center. Thanks for that underreported story and for all your contributions today. Sarah Studeville of Seattle Globalist, Aaron Burkhalter of Real Change, and Hannah Brooks Olson of Seattle-ish. Thanks, guys, for being on Sound Effect.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this week we're talking about boundaries. And KPLU's Ed Ronco is here now to tell us a story of two college friends who went on a trip that really tested the boundaries of their friendship. Hey, Ed.
Hi, Gabriel. So this story is about a guy named Craig Holt and his pal, Steve.
We were both lit majors in college, so highly employable people, obviously. We were fraternity brothers, and in the house, there was a group of us that they called the Study Geeks. Yeah, we kept the house grade point up, I guess, and we did not compete for the ladies. He was just so different from everybody else. This was, you know, the mid-80s in Seattle, so everybody else was all Flock of Seagulls hair and neon shirts, and we were pathetic. I believe I myself had a glam mullet and acid-washed jeans at the time. So Steve really stood out compared to other people.
All right, gotcha. I can identify with these guys. Okay, so after they graduated, they went on this trip together?
Yeah, they went on a trip for 4 months backpacking, as college students sometimes do after they graduate. But instead of going to Europe, which is kind of the, you know, destination of choice, right, they went to Africa. And the way Craig tells it, the stuff he wanted to see in Europe, he figured it's going to be there 30 years from now. The Colosseum's probably not going anywhere. But Africa, you know, things keep changing there, especially the wildlife. He wanted to see endangered animals that might go extinct, things like that.
I think my perception, too, of what I would find in Africa was a little bit, naive, maybe romantic. You know, deep jungle and the pounding of drums and, you know, very exotic and dangerous. And on the other hand, like a lot of kids my age, I had spent a lot of time looking through National Geographic, looking for pictures of topless women in far-off lands. It was Heart of Darkness with topless women, which is, you know, embarrassing to admit now, but frankly, true.
Okay, so with that in mind, they pack up and they head off to Africa. But I know you said this story is about testing the boundaries of their friendship, so I'm guessing things did not go quite as planned.
Right. They ran into some trouble, and not the good kind of trouble that, like, makes you better friends at the end of the trip. This was the kind of trouble that had the potential to rip their friendship apart. And, you know, I should just let Craig tell you the rest of the story.
We started in Zimbabwe. We went all through Zimbabwe for a long time. And then we went up from Malawi. We flew up to Kenya. And we decided to spend a little time on the coast in a place called Lamu, which was wonderful. And then we went back to Nairobi, and we were going to take a camel safari in northwestern Kenya out in the desert. The problem was, when we were in Lamu, Steve, he started to feel kind of off. And I whipped out the Pocket Doctor, which is this tiny little book, and it listed the symptoms of malaria. I believe there were 6. And for every single symptom, I said, well, do you have a headache? Yeah, but not too bad. Do you have fever? I think so, but not too bad. Every single one, he had the symptom. Obviously, Steve had malaria, but at the time, you know, we'd prepaid for the trip, so we figured we'd just go. Four days into this, Steve is, you know, completely fallen apart, and we are way out in the deserts of northwest Kenya, out past Lake Turkana. It would have been beautiful if we could have enjoyed it, because they had had spring rains, and you're out here in the hills and just gorgeous green and reds of the desert out in northwest Kenya. But Steve is, as far as I can tell, dying. You know, I'm about to lose my friend from the look of it. And the guides are very concerned. And so I put him in the tent that night, and I'm, you know, preparing hydration fluids. And I unzip the tent flap to bring him some hydration fluid. And the gush of hot air that his body had generated was like, you know, the air from a hairdryer that rushed out at me. And I thought, oh my God, this could be it. So I knew I had to cool him down somehow. So I dragged him out of the tent, you know, got the sleeping bag off him, just kind of laid him on his sleeping pad in his sleeping bag so he could be hopefully somehow a little less tortured by heat. Eventually, you know, I fell asleep out there. There's this noise, something moves. I close my eyes again, and then I hear something again. It's like something large has moved through the bushes, you know. And then I start to hear the grunting. And it's not a sound that any human could make. It's this huge, ominous, like, barrel-chested. I thought, oh my God, you know, something's coming into our camp. And so I pop up and I run back into the tent and shut the tent flap. Zoop. And that's when I realized I'd left Steve outside, totally exposed. And in that moment, having spent 4 days desperately trying to keep my friend alive, I thought, screw it. Steve's going to die anyway. And, you know, it's not the kind of thing you like to admit about yourself, but after all that time, trying so hard to keep him going, there was that moment where, when it came down to it's me or it's Steve, by God, I plumped for me. I left my dearest friend out there to be eaten by some wild animal. I'm not proud of that. Finally, the thing moved off and Steve became important to me again. And I dragged him back into the tent and cared for him all that night. That next morning, I said, hey, you got a little sleep. Anything else come up last night? And he said, no. And, you know, talked a little bit about hallucinations, but he didn't say anything about giant growling beasties. Kind of amazingly, we found a nun running a small clinic out in the bush, and we got Steve quinine, and that cured him. The rest of the trip was great. We had a wonderful time. But, you know, in the back of my mind, I felt terrible. Every time I'd look at Steve, I would feel so glad that he was okay for a second, and then I would feel like such a jerk. Like, really, not just a jerk, but like deeply evil inside. A few nights later, we were sitting by the campfire. Everybody else had gone to bed, and I couldn't take it anymore. I said, Steve, I have to admit something to you. This is awful, but I left you to die. And I told him the story of that animal coming into the camp and how I cowered in the tent while he was out there. And Steve just smiled at me and said, really, don't worry about it. I would have done the same for you. Amazingly, having admitted that I abandoned Steve to death, we are still very close friends.
Does he live in the area?
Yeah, we're both.
So Steve will hear this.
Yeah, Steve will hear this.
That story from KPLU's Ed Ronco. You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today we are probing boundaries. Boundaries in our region, in our history, and in all kinds of different ways. And there was one year in particular where the boundaries of Seattle underwent a radical transformation. I've been calling this the year Seattle gobbled everything. The year was 1907, and here to rehash it a little bit with me is Lorraine McConaughey, who's the public historian emeritus with the Museum of History and Industry. Welcome back, Lorraine.
Hey, thank you, Gabriel.
Could you kind of describe the map? Like, what did Seattle look like in, let's say, 1906, and what was around it?
Well, you have to imagine Seattle the way it is today, and then you start in your imagination to take things away. To take away Harbor Island, it didn't exist yet. You have to take away Georgetown. It wasn't part of Seattle yet, nor was Laurelhurst, or West Seattle, or Ballard. And you think, what's left? And it is the core of Seattle that's left.
Just the core, that kind of like little block of Seattle's core. And so what was in the place of where all those other things were?
We're talking about suburban towns, and that's what they were called in the Post-Intelligencer and the Seattle Times at that time, suburban towns. So Georgetown had its own town hall, and it's still standing there today. Ballard called itself the Pittsburgh of the Pacific and saw itself very much as an independent industrial city.
So you have this core, this urban core, and then you've got these tiny little towns all around it. How did that map change over the course of 1907?
In 1907, we see annexation to Seattle of what was called Southeast Seattle at the time, Ravenna, South Park, Columbia City, Ballard, West Seattle, and Rainier Beach, and then 3 years later, Georgetown and Laurelhurst. It's almost impossible to conceive of Seattle without these neighborhoods.
What were they like? I mean, it's hard to imagine a place like Ballard as anything but another neighborhood in Seattle. But what was it like in the early 20th century?
It was tremendously industrial. It was very much a blue-collar community. It was very much an immigrant community. You could walk down the street and you would hear Danish, you would hear Swedish, you would hear Norwegian. There seemed to have been churches on virtually every corner.
So Ballard and many of these places had to vote, of course, to join Seattle. And this is a little drama that played out in each of those communities that you mentioned. But we'll take Ballard as a kind of a case study. So when it came up for a vote, what was the result?
It took three votes for this to be decided. And in the end, it was a close vote. It was not a landslide. So that is the voice of the people. And for whatever their reasons were, they took some persuasion to decide to become part of the city. In my opinion, the deciding factor was schools. Seattle public schools were, like everything else in Seattle, expanding hugely, and they were in competition with real city schools. Seattle had an inferiority complex about almost every aspect of every major city. Boston has an arboretum. We have to have an arboretum. Los Angeles has a really good zoo. We have to have a really good zoo. And it went on and on like this with this sort of urban envy. But our schools were the envy of the Pacific Northwest. The schools that Seattle would bring to Ballard, I think, were what decided the 1907 vote.
So do you think, I'm asking you to give an opinion here, but do you think that we lost something in all these annexations? I mean, that we lost the distinct identities of these little towns that once ringed the urban core of Seattle?
Yes, and I think you could have found people who would have agreed with that stance in the 1920s. You can almost see it in the insistence of journalists that Ballard remain Scandinavian. And there are these laments, you know, every 6 months. But, you know, I went here and this bakery was closed and I went there and this is not the same and that is not the same. This is life. This is change. And
was it a kind of it all went to pot once we joined Seattle kind of an attitude?
I think there were people who had that, yes.
Yeah.
But, you know, some of that is just a presentism, and it's arguing with the reality of change. You really... Fighting off annexation would not have prevented the change to Ballard that has taken place. I really don't see how.
So, Lorraine, has looking at this series of events, annexations and changes in the map very closely, made you think one way or the other about the kind of the nature of boundaries, whether they're really arbitrary or whether they're some kind of real expression of something very human, or are they purely bureaucratic? I mean, what is the meaning of them?
That's a really interesting question to think about when you sort of look at boundaries as a spectrum of what they are. They seem very porous in some ways. You don't know when you've passed from Kirkland to Bellevue or whatever. But the bureaucracy of a boundary is very, very real. Fences, edges, borders, boundaries, our lives are filled with them. And the annexation story of 1907 and 1910 is as much, I think, about small towns, what were called suburbs in 1907 and 10, wanting to share Seattle as it was about Seattle wanting to glom on to them. Think about it. Seattle was becoming a city of what were then called skyscrapers, of six-story buildings. The plans for Smith Tower were on the board. The regrades were creating a real city, a rational city, and this sense of competition with Portland, for instance. We continued to express that by, I think, maybe wholesome competition and pride in achievement, that we were becoming a real city like Boston or Minneapolis or San Francisco. And I think that there was, you know, not just a centrifugal force pushing out the towns in the way that you suggest, but I think there was a willingness to join in to the center and be part of a real city in the Pacific Northwest, the only real city north of Portland.
Lorraine McGonigal is public historian emeritus at the Museum of History and Industry, and she joined us to talk about the year Seattle gobbled everything. Thanks, Lorraine.
Hey, thanks.
You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. We're talking about boundaries today, and we're going to talk about some boundaries that we live very near and but are often invisible to people. We're going to make them a little bit more visible today. I'm here with Jackie Jacobs, who is a communications professional here in Seattle, and she's the media relations coordinator for the Quileute Tribe, among other things. And she's one of the authors of an interesting new ebook called The Indian Country Style Book for Editors, Reporters, and Writers. Hey, Jackie, welcome.
Thank you. Hi, Gabriel. It's a pleasure to be here.
So how did you get involved in this project? What made the need for it so clear?
It was during a personal experience, or many personal experiences, serving the Quileute Nation, where some egregious behaviors happened that really brought to the forefront the need to educate outside reporters on how to conduct themselves when they are covering Indian country.
And it may go without saying, but just remind people why the Quileute Nation has particular need of somebody to interface with media.
Right. Well, the Quileute Tribe were thrust into the international spotlight as a result of the Twilight Saga phenomenon, which everybody has heard of. And the Quileute Tribe is a real nation of people situated on the Olympic Peninsula. And in this movie franchise, they are represented by the quote-unquote werewolves. So it's like a spotlight was thrust on this very tiny fishing village, and everybody wanted some sort of detail or morsel about their people.
And so that brings media attention.
Lots and lots of media attention.
How did that go?
Members of MSNBC Network, without permission, entered the sovereign nation, entered the Quileute lands, and they went into the tribal cemetery, which not only is off limits from a common sense perspective, it's also protected by federal law. It's a sacred site in every indigenous community in the United States of America. Now, the purpose of their story was to compare and contrast the vampires and the werewolves, right? So when they were in Forks, everything was bright and light and beautiful and airy. And the moment they turned down the road to come into the reservation and showcase the Quileute, i.e. the werewolves, everything turned dark and very moody and disturbing, actually. And then when I was watching this video, what I saw next, as a Native American woman, almost caused my heart to explode. They had taken those images they captured during their visit of a hereditary chief's tombstone. They zoomed in and out of that and put the background music to that image as some sort of goth kind of theme music. It was the most heartbreaking thing I think I'd ever seen.
So besides being in pretty poor taste, I think most people would agree, just by common sense, they were also in another nation. So
yes.
Talk about what that means. When someone, a non-Indian, crosses the boundary into Indian country, what changes?
You are literally entering into a country within the country. So each individual tribe has their own rules, regulations, guidelines, policies, and procedures that you have to follow.
Right. So that's a mistake that I think any sane person would think, wow, that was pretty bad taste. But there are a million, maybe more well-intentioned mistakes that people can make just out of ignorance, not knowing the right words and stuff like that. And that is what this style book really digs into. It's an alphabetized style book, sort of like the AP style book, which is something that reporters use to figure out what the right spelling of something is or something like that. And I wonder if we could go over a few of these to talk about them. So for example, the entry for songs. What is the purpose of that entry? What are you trying to clarify?
Well, a lot of people refer to our traditional songs as chants, and they're not chants. It's really a derogatory term sort of taken off the cadence of which Native Americans sing.
I'm just trying to think of like what the root of that is. Like, where does that come from and why would that be off-putting?
Well, I think, again, that it comes from the same source, and that's Hollywood. I think that Hollywood is the sole driver in identifying what Native America is, and we are far more complex than leathers and feathers.
Well, speaking of Hollywood and leathers and feathers, one of the common mistakes is talking about the clothing, and particularly ritualistic or ceremonial clothing, as costumes.
Yeah, that's another dagger to the heart. Costume, when I hear the word costume, I think of dress up. Regalia is the correct term that should be used and not costume, because costume sort of makes it a caricature or a cartoon. And regalia is the ancestral clothing of which every single Native American tribe has worn from the beginning of time.
One entry that I didn't see in there was an entry, well, it's in there obliquely, but the term Indian itself. Mm-hmm. And I think this is something that a lot of non-Indians grew up being a little bit confused about, actually. Mm-hmm. The term Indian is American Indian, Native American. How do you navigate that?
That's a really interesting question. And our neighbors up in Canada are referred to as First Nations.
Right.
You don't refer to them as Native American or American Indian. I personally think that that is an individual choice. Well, I can speak to myself personally. As a young girl in school, before Native American became the politically correct word to use, I was the American Indian in class. So I have friends who would refer to just be called Native American. I really honestly believe that's individual choice.
So first, if you don't know, number one, listen. And
yes.
If you have to speak first, is Native American probably the safest?
I would say yes.
That seems fair. Yeah. Well, Jackie Jacobs is a Seattle-based marketing professional, and she's the media relations coordinator for the Quileute tribe. And she's one of the authors of Indian Country Style Book for editors, reporters, and writers. It's available as an ebook. We're going to have a link to it at kplusoundeffect.org. Jackie Jacobs, thank you so much.
Thank you, Kevin.
You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this week's show is all about boundaries. So up next, we're going to talk about one of the most intimate spaces in which we set our boundaries, and that's how we set them with our romantic partners when they're not the only ones we want to sleep with. All right, a heads up, a belated heads up probably, that this story is going to concern some adult topics, obviously. So here to tell us a little bit more about it is KPLU's Matthew Stribe. Hey, Matthew.
Hi, Gabriel.
So are we talking about your relationship here?
No, me and my imaginary boyfriend are very monogamous, but we can talk about other people's relationships.
Okay, all right, let's do it.
So in the traditional relationship arc, there's two people who date for a while, then decide they can't do any better, and have a long conversation about being exclusive to each other. And then they only have sex with each other until someone dies or they divorce.
Ah, Matthew, bleak.
It's, well, whatever, that's how it goes in my mind. But what about the people who decide that they don't want to stop sleeping with other people? Where do they draw the lines? So I know a couple named Kaylin and James, and their relationship is extremely open. They said they want to talk to me because they think open relationships are the way of the future, and they're a very progressive couple, but they didn't want their last names on the radio because they're worried about stigma.
Got it. Okay, so Kaylin and James. So take somebody like Kaylin. What's the problem that she's got with monogamy?
Well, she said it stifled her.
monogamy isn't like a biological thing for me. If I'm in a relationship with someone, that doesn't mean I stop being attracted to other people. And I think that's true for most people, right? But when I was in a relationship with someone, I would always feel so guilty every time I was attracted to someone else. And I felt like I can't tell my partner that I'm interested in this other person because it would hurt them too much. So I have this secret that I'm keeping from them and I'm ashamed of it. And I just didn't want to live that way anymore.
And James wanted an open relationship so he could explore his bisexuality.
I've been in relationships for a while with people, and eventually wanting to be with someone of a different gender just kind of builds up. Like, no one person could fill that for me. Oh, that was a cringe sentence, huh? Mm-hmm.
So they set up these rules about how they were going to navigate being in a relationship and still having sex with other people.
Only one night stands with people that you don't know. No overnight stays at somebody else's house. No repeat hookup.
That is extremely detailed. Is this like a common thing? I mean, why is it so important to have such detailed rules?
Well, I think that's one of the mainstays of an open relationship is you have to talk about when and where you're going to have sex with other people, because otherwise that's just cheating and that's not an open relationship.
I see. Got it. Okay, so these rules, do they work?
Well, for them, not at all. The first time they tried it, the rules were immediately broken, and they each made dates to hook up with other people one night, and then James never came home.
After we had had sex, we were lying there for just, 1 minute, and it was just going to be 1 minute. And then all of a sudden I opened my eyes and it was light out, and I jumped out of bed and I was like, holy crap.
So I was, couldn't sleep all night. I was just lying there awake being like, oh my God, what have we done? This was a huge mistake. Now he doesn't even want to come back home, and he's just like so infatuated with this other person that he's just totally forgotten about me or forgotten about the rules or whatever. And I felt sick to my stomach, it was horrible.
Power walked all the way back home, and I crawled into bed and we just started talking about it, and I apologized profusely, and we both acknowledged that we're going to make you can't do this without making some really big mistakes that are going to hurt the other person. It's a dangerous game.
That incident was about 2 years ago, and now they've rewritten rules to the point where they tell each other everything.
Everything. And so, how every is everything.
It's pretty much everything. The only thing that they can do without talking to the other person first is kissing. They can kiss whoever they want at any time.
Kissing's a freebie.
Yeah, I mean, I guess they think that's pretty innocuous. But when it comes to doing anything more with someone else, they have long discussions about when they can do it, who they can do it with, how often they can do it. And now they're at the point where they frequently have sex with each other's best friends, and that's okay.
Wait, what? Best friends?
Yeah, they'll have dinner parties, and they'll have had sex with everyone in the room, and they're all okay with that. It's one happy family.
Good Lord. Well, it seems very progressive, I guess, is one way of thinking about it. But I'm just wondering, is this a new thing? Is this more common now than in the days of yore?
Well, I mean, that's hard to say. I mean, Zeus and Hera had kind of an open relationship thousands of years ago.
True.
But I did find this woman named Kate Stewart. She's a psychoanalyst in Seattle who specializes in all types of relationships that have more than two people in them. And last year she wrote this book called The Open Relationship Handbook. And in her research, she's found that the open relationships as we know them are a relatively new phenomenon.
During World War I was when kind of modern swinging started. There was at a base, I think it was at a naval base or an Air Force base, there was a group of fighter pilots who had agreed if something happened to them that they would kind of like take care of each other's wives. And that evolved into kind of sharing sexual partners amongst this group. And from that, it kind of took off and I think still maintained some kind of underground status, but really kind of kept going until it became more visible in the 70s, right, when you're talking about key parties. And then the kind of polyamory movement that we've seen has been more in like late 90s up until currently, when I think the internet made it much more visible.
So at the end of that clip there, she's talking about polyamory. And this is where open relationships get a little bit more complicated. Kate said that there are levels of types of open relationships. The first is what Kaylin and James have, where they're in a committed relationship and they have sex with other people. Then there are swingers who play together as a couple. And then there are couples who date romantically outside of the relationship. And finally, there's polyamory, where there's multiple people in one committed relationship.
So I'm just trying to sort of picture why people enter into these relationships. I mean, besides sort of sowing your wild oats, you know, what are the reasons that you would choose this kind of relationship?
Well, with James and Kaylin, it went back to honesty. And rather than sweep issues of jealousy that they had under the rug, they dealt with them head on. Kate Stewart said that that's kind of the main appeal.
It does seem like open relationships, it's hard to say they function better. It's hard to say they would last longer or that anything like that. But I would say once you've opened the door to be able to talk about these things, relationships can really come through a lot harder things because people have said this sometimes the scariest things they can say, which is, you know what, I want to have sex with other people or that type of thing. So I think there's more resiliency in these relationships. And I do, the other thing that is interesting is the thing I always say is a rising tide lifts all boats, right? So if one partner or both partners are having sex with other people, oftentimes that improves their own sex life together because there's newness. There is like that kind of sexual like excitement is there. And so that kind of can make people make people's relationship really happy.
But Kate did say that there are also drawbacks to open relationships. Having so many sexual partners can be kind of another full-time job and it leaves little room for other hobbies. And there's always a threat of jealousy and the worry that one of the people will fall in love outside of the relationship.
Well, how could you not be worried about that? I mean, that seems like the most natural thing in the world.
Yeah, I don't think I could handle it. I am a jealous Janet, and James and Kaylin still have that fear.
We do meet other people that we like.
We've done that.
And it's not, you know, we love each other, and there's other people that we like, and maybe someday there will be other people that we love. We haven't crossed that bridge yet, but we leave the door open that maybe it'll happen.
The reality is everyone takes on that risk every day. The people that we hook up with more and more, we're encountering, you know, them being real people. And I'm not sure exactly where that's going to lead us. But it's definitely not as black and white as I think we both thought it would be.
So Matthew, what I'm left wondering is, I mean, have they, by being in this open relationship, have they just done away with boundaries altogether?
It's not that an open relationship has fewer boundaries. It's that they're very different and they're not as clear cut. And what makes it difficult is that there's not a lot of societal models for them to draw from. So they kind of have to make it up as they go.
Well, this story from KPLU's Matthew Strybe. I say KPLU's Matthew Strybe. Really, he's in kind of an open relationship with us. But thanks for coming on Sound Effect, Matthew.
No problem. I'm a public radio swinger.
Sound Effect is produced by Arwen Nix and Kevin Kniestedt. We had stories today from KPLU's Ed Ronco and Matthew Strybe. And thanks to MOHI, the Museum of History and Industry in Seattle. Our executive producer is Erin Hennessy, and she gets extra props today for helping us serve up Sound Effect encores all week on KPLU's Fun Drive. You can still give, by the way, at kplu.org. You can find our podcast on iTunes and write a review there if you're so inclined, or tell us what you think right to our face. Or, you know, virtual face, you can email soundeffect@kplu.org. Come on back next week when we'll feature creatures.
How do you feel about animal communicators?
I'm Gabriel Spitzer. This is 88.5 KPLU.